Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to Stock Club, a podcast brought to you by My Wall Street. I'm James, and joining me on today's episode are Emmett and Rory from the My Wall Street analyst teams. Today, we're talking about General Electric and Johnson & Johnson breaking themselves up, Opendoor and Airbnb's recent earnings calls, and our first thoughts on the soon-to-be public company, Sweetgreen. So guys, thanks for joining me today. Rory, welcome back from your holidays. Have you had a chance to listen to last week's episode yet?
No, I haven't. I heard it got grilled.
We were having a conversation about Peloton and we didn't think it would be right that we talked about Peloton without mentioning yourself. What were your thoughts on Peloton's recent troubles?
Well, that's why I left the country, you know, to avoid having to talk about it. It was a terrible quarter. It really was. I mean, it wasn't as bad as I think the stock reacted to. A lot of it seemed to be just a forecasting problem in terms of management.
Yeah.
They definitely seem to have kind of gotten a little bit ahead of themselves. I think the issue will be now is how much have they built for demand that is waning? You know, if they've ended up building for a $50 billion business in the next couple of years and it's not going to be that, then that's going to increase their costs. It's going to, you know, depress their margins. But I think it's all fixable. I still think it's a strong business. And I think if you take a business that's gone from, like, you know, 3 billion, 4 billion market cap to 45 billion market cap in the space of a year, you're going to see those kind of growing pains.
Yeah.
Look, we'll see how they get on over the next quarter. If it continues to be a trend, I think that's where you're really going to see the problems. But in terms of, you know, the subscriber numbers were still up. They're still forecasting strong subscriber numbers. Engagement was a bit down, but I think that would be expected. It was the summer. People had been locked up for 2 years. They were going out a bit more. They weren't exercising quite as much.
As Mike said, people were going drinking.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. You know, when the pubs are open and you haven't been in them in 2 years, you're not going to be on your exercise bike as much as you were the year before. I'm pretty zen about it.
What about you, Emmett? Have you ever fled the country because a stock prediction didn't go your way?
I'd never be home. no, I haven't, but it's a great idea, Rory, and I really appreciate it.
It's probably an expense to the company as well, is it? It's one of your perks.
Yeah. Oh, it's all expensed. Yeah, absolutely. It's been a while since me and Emmett are just doing this podcast by ourselves.
It is.
The old, getting the old band back together.
The old crew, the OGs.
John and Paul.
The original gangsters, yeah. Great.
That better not make me Ringo.
No, you're Yoko.
Right. So let's move on.
I have a great Beatles fact, by the way. You're going to love
this. Okay, go for it.
Previously to Ringo Starr, the drummer for the Beatles was a guy called Pete Best. And years later, when the Beatles were, you know, massive band, he very cynically released an album called Best of the Beatles in order to try and profit off their success. I think that's brilliant. That's great.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I would buy that just like to give him the credit for a great title for an album. So let's move on then. And so over the past few weeks, we've had news of not one, but two iconic companies deciding to break up with themselves. First up was General Electric, the company founded by Thomas Edison back in 1892 and probably one of the most classically American companies you could ever imagine. Management has said that GE will split into separate publicly traded companies for its aviation, its healthcare and its energy businesses. Healthcare will be spun off in early 2023 and the separation of its renewable energy and power business will occur in early 2024. Next up then was Johnson & Johnson, who also followed suit, announcing last week that it plans to separate its business along its consumer products business and its pharmaceutical and medical devices operations. Both of these will become publicly traded companies when the split happens within the next 2 years, it's expected. So on this podcast, we talk quite a lot about companies merging and coming together, but I don't think we've actually ever really spoken about a company literally breaking apart. We've spoken about how Facebook maybe should break apart, start, but it's never actually happened. Rory, what's going on here? Why are these two companies splitting up?
This is a funny topic for us to discuss, because for as long as I've been with this company, nearly 7 years now, we've maybe mentioned Johnson & Johnson once. I don't think we've ever, in my recollection, mentioned General Electric. It's even though it is like such a huge business, such a huge part of the stock market. This was huge news, though. It was certainly for GE, if not so much the Johnson & Johnson one. I mean, undoubtedly there's some listeners out there who aren't even sure what General Electric do, particularly non-US listeners, but even US listeners, I think, because it's such a massive, huge business that did like so many little things and didn't really seem to have that kind of one business that you could really like put your finger on. But this goes back. This was founded by J.P. Morgan, not the bank J.P. Morgan. The actual J.P. Morgan was one of the founders of this business. And what it was a kind of amalgamation of various businesses that had been formed by Thomas Edison, and was founded in 1892 in Schenectady, New York. And their first product was a light bulb. There's actually a novel based on how this business was founded that I read last year called The Last Days of Night, which is all about the feud between Edison and George Westinghouse, Nikola Tesla. If you're looking for any historical accuracy, it's not really a book I'd recommend, but it's a decent holiday read, I suppose. But GE was one of the original 12 companies that made up the Dow Industrial.
So it's an OG.
It's a literal OG. Like I said, first product was pretty much light bulbs. But over the next 100 years, the company became involved in basically anything you can possibly think of related to electricity or electricity generation. Any part of that value chain, from generating the power to anything you can put in a plug socket, GE was pretty much in that business. Fridges, fans, toasters, ovens, x-rays, televisions, television stations, radio stations. They got into turbo engines for planes in the kind of the 30s and 40s, were vital to the efforts in World War II. They are like a truly like a iconic American business up there with Ford, IBM, US Steel. However, there really became, I think, this kind of overarching belief throughout the entire business that GE was such a great company with such great managers that they could literally run any business better than anyone else. And it got to the point where they really didn't care kind of how bad or how misaligned the business was with General Electric. They just believed that their management style was so brilliant that they could take anything and make it a success. And I think anyone who's ever watched kind of 30 Rock will certainly know this from Alec Baldwin's character. he's just full of like management talk and Six Sigma and all these like borrowed functions from Japanese automakers and just being very efficient and doing lots of market research. And then came along this guy in 1981 called Jack Welch, whose management style was incredibly hands-on. He insisted on knowing absolutely every aspect of the business. And he was a tough manager. He had a kind of attitude. His thing, one of his phrases was, fix it, close it, or sell it. He wanted any business GE were in, he wanted to be either number one or number two. And that was it. If we weren't number one or number two, he'd get rid of that company. He also brought in this kind of management style called rank and yank, where every year all the employees ranked each other and the top 10% were automatically fired.
that sounds like an awful, awful time.
Yeah, I mean, look, this was like, you know, the 80s and 90s. It was pretty cutthroat. He used to justify it as an act of kindness. He was like, look, if they're not fitting in here, better send them off and get them to find something else to work on. But I mean, they became incredibly inquisitive, this business. They acquired NBC. They got really heavily into insurance and financial services in particular, which, you know, really had nothing to do with the original General Electric. And at one point, GE Capital, this kind of financial services part of the business, was half the company's revenue.
Yeah.
And, you know, Welch retired in 2001, was named Fortune's greatest manager of the century. And then came along this guy called Jeff Immelt, who was a pretty unlucky character. Not only was he following in Fortune's manager of the century, you know, anyone follows soccer will know when Alex Ferguson retired, that was a tough act to follow. But he took the job in September 2001, and 4 days later, 9/11 happened, and GE was on the line for a huge insurance invoice for that, which really kind of exposed the risks in the business and led to a serious downturn. Then, you know, the financial crisis came along not too long after that. And Immelt decided to kind of sell off the financial side of the business. He bulked up, he tried to bring the business back into the industrial side of things, bulked up on acquisitions, made a $13 billion acquisition of Alstom, a French company, which was in real dire straits itself. But the problem was, without the capital side of the things, the company couldn't support its dividend, essentially, which was everything that people thought about when they thought about GE. One of those things that, you know, people are, it's one of those kind of 101s of investing, invest in dividend companies, the dividend aristocrats. We have a ETF in there with dividend aristocrats, companies that never cut their dividend, always keep pumping it up. And GE was one of these dividend businesses that you just relied on the business for. And when Immelt stepped down, his successor, John Fannery, announced that they had to cut it, that they hadn't been generating enough cash flow for years in order to pay this dividend. So they were essentially, you know, not growing the business as a result of having to pay this dividend.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can look at the stock chart, the stock lost, I think, something like 90% from its highs. Huge for a business that used to be the biggest business in the world. Back in, I think, 2000, it was the biggest business in the world. The new manager, Culp, has come in. He's basically said, look, we can't, this is too big a machine to run. We're going to have to break it up. And, you know, I think it's a real kind of signifier of the end, perhaps.
Yeah.
The canary in the coal mine of the big conglomerate, or at least definitely this way of doing things. This way of being like, well, we're such a great business that just buying anything makes it more valuable. You know, just by being part of our family means that this is a more valuable asset, because that clearly wasn't the case. And, you know, I mean, I think Johnson & Johnson, it's weird that it kind of happened at the same time, but it's probably not quite the same issue. Johnson & Johnson, obviously, mass conglomerate as well. They have over 100 subsidiaries broken into kind of three operating segments, which is pharma, medical device, and consumer health. Really what they're doing is they're just spinning off the consumer health segment, which is its smallest. It's not actually its slowest growing. That's the medical device business, both basically being flat for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
But I mean, you can certainly see the synergies in keeping pharma and medical devices together, whereas consumer healthcare is a different kind of ballgame. But yeah, I mean, Johnson & Johnson doesn't really have the same issues that GE did. It's currently paying a 3.1% dividend. It's using half its free cash flow to do that. And it's one of the dividend aristocrats. So, I mean, two kind of similar but very different stories at the same time. The GE one, definitely end of an era.
Yeah, well, just to go back to that point, because I think that's an interesting point, the kind of the death of the conglomerate. And we see a lot of, you know, we were recently talking about, you know, the biggest companies 10 years ago and the biggest companies now. And there's such a shift in terms of industry and the type of companies. But I think that idea of conglomerates and that concept of a style of company or a structure of company coming to an end. And it seems like a lot of the companies we talk about today and a lot of the exciting companies today are maybe good at one very specific thing and do that very well. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, you could make almost a kind of comparison to the old kind of way tech used to work, with these kind of enterprise resource platforms where, you know, you had to get everything off SAP.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't pick and choose. Everything had to be run off on SAP. And today, businesses don't do that. They want to get their HR from Workday. They want to get their customer service from Zendesk. They want to get their accounting software from Blackline. They want it all to plug into a central planning software. And, you know, when I think back about, like, we've never had a conglomerate in our showroom. Disney, maybe, is the, but like,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of the biggest kind of
an intellectual property conglomerate. Maybe.
Yeah, we've never had one of those. We've never had Whirlpool or Procter & Gamble or any of those big conglomerates, because they never really spoke to us in terms of the things we look for in a great investment, which is kind of visionary leaders, you know, simple, straightforward businesses, you know, that great growth. They just seem to be these kind of dinosaurs of these that you were like trying to figure out, what do they actually do? What's the business here?
Yeah, they're so big, they're nearly countries in themselves or governments in themselves. So I suppose the question, and if there is anyone listening who is a shareholder in either of these companies, what happens? Do you get a bit of all of these new companies, or do we have any insight into what's going to happen if you're a shareholder?
Yeah, you'll just get the whatever way it'll split, you'll get shares in each business. I mean, I've never really followed GE as a business, but from what I do know, this seems like a great move by the management, because it just had to happen. I think their aviation business is actually quite strong. It's the power business that's really been a huge drag on that company for years. And so, you know, breaking them up and being able to focus on the strengths of each business separately is probably a better idea for them.
we pitched around a few ideas for new names for Facebook when they announced their name change recently. Have we got any ideas for either of these companies when they're breaking up?
I know. Well, I'd like to mention a wildly successful competition I launched on Twitter when this exciting news broke from J&J, where I asked people to suggest a name for the two new companies, with the winner getting a shout out on Stock Club. And well, the undisputed victor by a majority landslide was the only entrant, and it was Neuromancer. Neuromancer, who goes by at Ireland's Offline, and his ideas for the two new companies were Jimmy Johnson and John Johnson, and then Johan Johansson. So which in fairness was pretty good considering he was going to win no matter what.
Yeah. I like that.
Anne-Marie came up with Johnson and Wes Johnson, which I thought was quite good.
Yeah, and Jamie said Jack Johnson and John Jackson.
Yeah, nice tongue twister there. Yeah. It's tougher to come up with the General Electric ones. You can't have as much fun with General Electric, I don't think. So let's move on then. And on the last episode of Stock Club, we spoke about some recent earnings reports and how they kind of told us a lot about the state of the wider market at the moment. Well, the earnings reports are still coming in thick and fast, as our analysts know. And there are two recent reports that I want to zone in on today, Opendoors and Airbnbs. Emmett, I'm going to come to you first about Opendoor, as it's one of the companies within the Horizon portfolio that you look at regularly. After Zillow's hasty exit from the iBuying market recently, a lot of people were looking towards Opendoor's earnings to see if this was a Zillow-specific issue or if it was a wider problem with the iBuying market in general. What did we learn from Opendoor's earnings about this?
Well, if I may, James, let me just start with a quick recap of what happened with Zillow, which I know has been previously discussed in Stock Club, but, you know, there's several blurred lines. And Zillow's Zestimate of home values is, for everyone in America, the go-to reference for homeowners. But what they did, as our listeners will probably know, is they tried to use this algorithm to buy and sell homes, and it went badly wrong. And Zillow's iBuyer division, where firms, you know, iBuying is where like firms use algorithms to quickly value, buy and sell homes, launched in 2018 in Phoenix, a few years after Opendoor. And the principle behind iBuying is very simple. You leverage your data or big data and estimate a price at which you can buy and sell a property and make a profit in between. And what generally an iBuyer will do is offer lower prices than traditional buyers, but attract sellers, you know, on the promise of a faster all cash deal. Mm. And I basically had the precursor to iBuying in my life years ago. Well, half of the deal. So what happened was years ago, 10 years ago, my wife and I were moving house. My family and I were moving house. We brought the kids, I suppose. and I knocked into our next door neighbor to tell her that we were going to sell. And there was a for sale sign going up in the garden, only to end up shaking on a sale with her daughter the next day below the market rate, in order to minimize hassle. So when iBuying as a trend emerged in recent years, it spoke to me. I think it would speak to most people, because selling houses is notoriously stressful. It's costly. It costs time and effort, and you have to have your house presentable, and you have to get out of it several times in the course of the process for people to look around. Anyway, iBuyers do all of that with a website. And once an iBuyer owns a home, an iBuyer, of course, being Opendoor or previously Zillow, it works quickly to renovate the property, relist it, and then in theory a profit. There was an analysis of millions of home sales across the US between 2013 and 2018 by boffins at Stanford, Northwestern, and Columbia, I think. And they found that iBuyers made around 5% profit with their home flipping. And as, again, I'm sure you discussed in a previous episode, Zillow believed it had the secret to the iBuying world, which was the Zestimate. And they launched in 2006. It was trained on millions of homes across America. And that's basically what Zillow had. Now, before I get onto Opendoor, apparently the tech firms all choose Phoenix as the city to tweak their model, because apparently homes in the city are of a consistent and standard design, which allows them to kind of tweak their model and their algorithm very well. Anyway, in October of this year, Zillow recorded its most active week of buying homes ever in Phoenix City, which was part of its goal to buy 5,000 homes a month by 2024. Then suddenly, overnight, it just stopped. It literally just stopped. The guillotine fell. And as we all know, then a few weeks later, co-founder of Zillow, I think his name is Rich Barton, said that basically they were getting out of the market and it just wasn't working. And they shuttered its iBuying arm and said it was going to cut 25% of the workforce. Zillow was absolutely slammed. Okay, so what that did as a backstory was create a question mark over the entire industry that is iBuying and the entire movement. So Act 2, Scene 1, enter Opendoor, who reported this past week, and for most of our listeners will know Opendoor only do iBuying. And they, by the way, paused their iBuying operations last year because of the virus. But let's just talk about how Opendoor did when they reported last week. Revenue grew 91% quarter over quarter to about $2.3 billion on the sale of just a couple short of 6,000 homes, like 5,995 homes or something, which was up 72% from Q2. Revenue per home sold increased by 11%. It purchased over 15,000 homes in the quarter, up about 80% from Q2. It also grew its inventory to around about 17,000 homes, which was worth $6.3 billion, an increase of 130%. Now, that's some heavy inventory for a business that's young and quote unquote small. To have $6.3 billion worth of bricks, mortar, wood and electricity cables, that's some serious inventory. And
that's surely the biggest risk factor for a company like Opendoor. Like, it's not like, I don't know, inventory like iPhones or something like that. These are bricks and mortar houses. These aren't easy to shift if they need to shift fast.
I think yes and no, James. Like, if you think about it, a home has a much, much, much longer shelf life, if you like, than a piece of technology, which, you know, is aging the minute it's made. I agree with you, but yeah, you're right. It's massive inventory to be holding. And really, the trick is you want to get it sold as soon as you have it renovated. And Opendoor clearly are confident because in the quarter, they also expanded to 5 new markets, defined as cities, I guess. And in other words, it now has 44 markets in which it operates. So the business, and by the way, net loss for the quarter was $57 million. And that kind of encapsulated stuff like stock-based compensation and whatever. But what really we heard in the earnings call with Opendoor last week was that the model works and that Zillow, the shockwave that Zillow sent through the industry was particular to Zillow.
Okay.
That it wasn't, or at least it's unlikely that the industry itself is, and it's a new industry, is actually not viable. It's a very viable business. So it is clearly high risk. And Opendoor has demonstrated the ability to navigate this risk. And it has more track history and more technology to operate more efficiently than its competitors. And the company's growth really has just been absolutely incredible. It's really been incredible. And the homes acquired, when you just look at that as a metric, in Q4 2020, you know, they acquired something like 2,500 homes. It kind of, by Q1 of this year, grew to just shy of 5,000 homes. By Q2, they bought 10,000 homes. And then, as we heard in the most recent quarter, 15,000 homes. So they are accelerating into the curve, so to speak. And it is a business that I believe, well, I'm very excited about it. I think it's, again, another industry that is being, that is disrupting an old world industry. iBuying is disrupting the old way things were done. And as I mentioned with my anecdote, like, I enjoyed the process of selling quickly way back when. It brings massive benefits to a seller and something that I think will become a norm as the years go by.
I think another element to remember with the Zillow thing was that Zillow did this to protect their other business, what used to be their core business, which they kind of turned up on its upside down and said, Opendoor don't have a core business to protect. This is their core business.
Yeah.
And the company was built from the very start to do this. So there is that element of like, well, you know, Zillow had to, you know, be careful as to what it stands to lose. Whereas Opendoor really kind of has nothing to lose. This is the whole thing. So they have to keep going and they have to keep pushing it. And they seem to be doing it quite well.
Yeah.
And in fact, and that kind of references back to the point you made earlier, Rory, about conglomerates kind of add layers on as the year go by, and then there's suddenly everything and they just need to bifurcate or split down and go back to basic principles. As you said, whether you Workday and Blackline or whatever, you want to have the expert in all the various fields. And iBuying is a very particular algorithm. It's a very particular formulatic way of making money. And you're dead right. Zillow had figured a way of making good money a different route. And it's good to see that they actually took that move and went back to doing what they do so well.
Yeah, a brave move indeed. Let's move on to Airbnb then, another company that reported recently. And Airbnb is really riding on a crest of a wave at the minute. Rory, what were the big highlights from Airbnb's report for you? A 280% jump in profits isn't bad going.
Yeah, they're certainly riding across to a wave. It's like travel good, stay at home bad. It seems to be the general narrative of the stock market right now. But no, this was a really important, it was a while ago, so we haven't talked about it, but it was an incredibly important quarter in Q3. It's typically where they generate 35% of their revenue from. And I think, you know, it showed clear signs of recovery in most of their KPIs and in their revenues, which, you know, is a very good indicator of a fast pandemic recovery. You know, keep in mind, this was a business that could have been on its knees during the pandemic. Their entire business model was disrupted.
Yeah.
And it, like you said, they saw gross bookings grow 49%. It was slightly below expectations, but only very slightly. They had record revenue up 69% year over year and 69% sequentially. Now, obviously, those was coming off some very soft comps. But again, it was, you know, the highest revenue the company had ever seen just a year or two after the biggest shock to the system a company like this could ever take. So, well, you know, first of all, well done management for that pretty rapid pivot. They also saw record profits with net income of $834 million. There was some kind of interesting tidbits from the earnings report that I think are deserving of a little bit of a read, which is they saw domestic and short distance travel have come back to above pre-pandemic level. Long distance international travel is steadily recovering. What I thought, and non-urban was their strongest section as well, which I thought was interesting.
People fleeing the cities.
Pretty much, yeah. And you know, there was a quote, I'm going to read a full quote from the shareholders letter, which is, "The world is undergoing a revelation in how we live and work. Technologies like Zoom make it possible to work from home. Airbnb makes it possible to work from any home. This newfound flexibility is bringing about a revolution in how we travel. Millions of people can now take more frequent trips, longer trips, travel to more locations, and even live anywhere on Airbnb. In fact, 20% of our nights booked between July and September were for stays of a month or longer, and nearly half were for stays of at least a week."
Wow.
I thought that was incredible. Like, there was just so much to unpack in that. And the kind of previous numbers that you kind of go, is the pandemic the best thing that's ever happened? And like, this is so early days in this. But like, when I think of my experience over Airbnb over the years, I didn't even know you could stay somewhere for longer than a month. Until 6 months ago when I first saw that kind of feature popping up. And now it's a quarter of or a fifth of their business.
I think it's reflected in the product as well, because Airbnb have brought in new features recently that kind of play into this long-term stay. They've brought in Wi-Fi verification, so you know the strength of a Wi-Fi in a place, which kind of hints towards obviously pleasure, but also working in a place. And there's that I'm flexible feature you mentioned has been expanded to like a month or a range of months too.
Yeah, I mean, so when this was happening and we were all working from home, I was going, God, it'd be great to, like, if you could, you'd love to go somewhere, you know, like San Sebastian for a month, you know, or just live a different city for a month and work. And the one thing I did think was like, oh, geez, you'd have to worry about the Wi-Fi, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So you go to an Airbnb and they're like, oh, yeah, we have Wi-Fi. It's like, you sort of have Wi-Fi. The icon is there. I'll give you that. But and that idea of verified Wi-Fi actually came through someone on Twitter getting onto Brian Chesky saying, hey, there should be a way you can verify Wi-Fi at these places because you never know what's coming. And they have innovated rapidly. They had 100 product innovations launched earlier this year. They just did 50 in their kind of winter update, which, as I said, included that speed test for Wi-Fi, more flexibility, new translation technology, which is obviously a big thing for Airbnb, and enhanced insurance for hosts, which has obviously become a huge issue for them as well. And, you know, when I was thinking about Airbnb before we added it, I thought, like, they really did turn the world of travel upside down. You know, when you think about companies like, you know, obviously the internet made travel a whole different ballgame. But when you think about companies like Booking and Expedia, for example, these online travel agents, they really just took something that was happening already in the real world and just moved it to digital. You know, that was kind of their thing. And well done to them. They've created multi-billion dollar businesses through it and made things substantially easier than it used to be. Obviously, I'm not saying they didn't deliver value. But what Airbnb did was really kind of move us away from this idea that we all had to end up in kind of the hotel district of some major metropolis where, you know, there was an abundance of tourist attractions, but also an abundance of terrible food and people who don't live in the city. You know, what Airbnb did was give us the freedom or the opportunity to live in cities, to actually like kind of be, even if it was only for a couple of days, you were staying somewhere where people actually lived, you're interacting with people who actually lived there, you're having food or coffee where locals actually went and had food or coffee. And that's a totally different experience than what you get if you, you know, book into an Ibis or a Hilton in the middle of some massive city. And I wonder if they could do this for this work for home movement as well. I think that's an incredibly exciting element of the business.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on then and have a look at some of the things going on around My Wall Street at the moment. Rory, you added a brand new stock to the My Wall Street shortlist this week. Emmett, I believe you're also getting a pitch ready for a new stock in Horizon next week. I won't ask you for any hints on it in case you spill the beans. Of course, it's Black Friday next week too, and there's some great deals coming for both the My Wall Street app and the Horizon service. For the next week, you can get $30 off of My Wall Street subscription. That's a 30% total discount, or a whopping $150 off a Horizon subscription. Remember, My Wall Street is the only place that you can access our hand-picked shortlist of stocks, as well as other great features like our first look reports on newly listed companies and more analysis and commentary from the analyst team on the market. Horizon, on the other hand, is the only place where you can see everything that Emmett does with his own personal portfolio, all the buys, all the sells, and all the companies that have caught his eye. Both of these offers are available now, but for a limited time only. So make sure to follow the links in the notes for today's show and grab these deals before they're gone. Guys, we've no time for mailbag today because obviously with the two of you guys on, we've spent way too much time talking.
And I didn't get to say anything about Airbnb. That's not fair.
Oh, yeah. Well, sorry. Are you legally allowed to say anything about Airbnb?
I think I am.
We'll leave that to the lawyers. So let's move on to the elevator pitch then to finish out today's show. So guys, classic elevator pitch. I want you to just pitch me a company you're researching at the moment. And I'm not even going to bother saying 30 seconds because I just know it's not going to be in 30 seconds. Emmett, you can go first, seeing as you didn't get to say your piece on Airbnb.
So about a year ago, a Horizon member called Brooke posted on our community about the fact that he works closely with the restaurant industry and provides software to a few brands. And at the time, he said that the restaurant company that he was most excited about is Sweetgreen. He said, and I quote, "Sweetgreen have strong leadership. The food is delicious. The locations are beautiful and they have a big following. They also have great foresight. They launched their Outpost program in 2019, which is essentially personalized catering." And for our listeners here in Dublin, Sweetgreen is a bit like Sprout. They do really nice high-end salads and, you know, whatever way you like them. So Sweetgreen has, since Brooke posted on our Horizon community, they've filed to go public with the SEC. Okay. And it looks likely to value the company at about $2.7 billion. And the chain is unprofitable since opening in 2007, has 140 restaurants in 13 states, and is on track to double in size over the next 3 to 5 years. On page one of their S1, which is the one that will get most of my attention because after WeWork, it really it's set to scene for that from that point on. But on page one of their S1, their mission statement is clear. Our mission is to build healthier communities by connecting people to real food, which sounds nice, but could be any restaurant, but still it's fine. And just before I wrap it, because I know we're about 15 seconds into my 30 seconds. The S1 also shows that Sweetgreen's 2021 revenue through to kind of middle September totaled about $250 million compared to about $160 million in the same period a year ago. So the revenue is growing. The company ended last year with about $140 million in losses. So on a restaurant level, I think it's a nice, I think I'm encouraged by the fact that somebody said it was great, because that ultimately is what drives a restaurant. But certainly from a profitability level, it doesn't score too well. When you look at the giants and the multiples that are out there, Sweetgreen would get, it would get a D. I'm not too keen on what I see when it comes to return on invested capital. But, you know, like all that stuff pales when you think of, you know, Chipotle was a very inefficient restaurant in its early days. Now look at it. The question is, can Sweetgreen create that customer evangelism far in new markets and new cities? And that remains to be seen.
Is inefficient the new word we're using for giving people food poisoning?
Someone on FinTech, I remember, who said when the S1 came out, said, delighted to see the venture capitalists have been paying for my $15 salad for the last 4 years.
Rory, what about you? What company are you looking at the moment?
Yeah, taking a look at a business called Alarm.com. Been an awful long time since we mentioned a .com on this podcast. It's a business I think a lot of people might be familiar with. They do kind of home security, smart doorbells. But when I looked at them, they're actually focused on so much more than that. They really kind of have a whole program of smart home and Internet of Things devices, everything from kind of your heating, your temperature, your garage door, your security. And they're growing pretty sustainably over the last kind of couple of years. They're expected to bring in about $725 million this year, and about $450 million of that is going to be in what they call their SaaS or licensing revenue. And at $4.3 billion, that kind of looks very interesting to me. You know, 10 times your recurring revenue, and you've also got a kind of hardware component tagged onto the business. It's almost one of those things where I'm kind of like, what's wrong with them?
Yeah, where's the catch?
What's the catch here? How you like, guys, it's a very competitive environment. There's a lot of companies in this space, or a lot of companies with big ambitions to own this space, including Amazon, as we know, who have purchased their one of their big competitors. So you know, it's early days looking at it, but it seems like an interesting business.
Worth
having a dig at.
Definitely. When we were all in the office, we had an Amazon Ring, and the flaw in the Amazon Ring was shown straight away when we realized that someone still had to go down to the door to open it. And it was just kind of like a Mexican standoff every time the bell rang, and we were looking at each other across the office. So that's it for today's show. Remember, if you have any questions you'd like us to answer or elevator pitches you'd like us to tackle, make sure to get in touch. You can find us in all the usual places. That's on Twitter at MyWallStreetHQ, on TikTok, that's at MyWallStreet, or just simply shoot us an email at pod@mywallstreet.com. If you're enjoying the show, tell your friends about us, and don't forget to leave us a review or a rating on whatever platform you listen to us on. From the three of us here today, thanks for listening in, and we'll talk to you next week.